Ramon Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Governor Gavin Newsom says all Californians have to wear a mask in public. Now, you might remember how Orange County pushed back on previous state mandates. In fact, county leaders are responding to Newsom right now. Find out what they have to say. Plus, the Supreme Court blocks the president from ending DACA. We'll hear what this means for the hundreds of thousands protected from deportation under the program. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. Emmy Martinez, happy Thursday to you. Coming up on the show.
The whole idea is that when you put on the headset and you're not a person of color, that you look down and you see that you're a black man.
The virtual reality experience that could bring more empathy to a national conversation about what it means to be black in America. A little later in the show, we'll meet the young designer who created it all. That's coming up in a few minutes. But we start today with an eye on the U.S. Supreme Court and a major decision out this morning. In a 5-4 vote, the court ruled that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, can continue for now. That's the program where around 650,000 immigrants who came to the U.S. as young children were shielded from deportation. Now, the Trump administration tried to end the program in early 2017, and in writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts noted that the court's ruling was not based on whether the program was legal. Instead, it ruled against the White House because of how it tried to end DACA. For more on this ruling and what happens next, let's talk to Jennifer Chacon. She's a professor of law at UCLA. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
All right. So what did the court say about the way President Trump tried to end the program and why it was not enough?
Right. So the plaintiffs in this case had raised two different challenges to the law. The first was actually a set of challenges that were framed around the notion that the administration had violated the particular process that they needed to follow in making this kind of an administrative decision. And the second set of arguments they raised were that the administration violated constitutional equal protection protections by rescinding this decision. So they said that this decision evinced discrimination against Mexicans and against Latinos, who are the largest group of beneficiaries. Today, the court agreed with the challenges regarding the process concerns. So they said that the rescission of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program requires particular processes in administrative decision making. And here we had a couple of problems that the court found. They said first, the administration's justification for rescinding DACA was that the program was illegal. And they said, it's not at all clear that DACA is illegal, and it's absolutely legal for the administration to exercise its discretion to refrain from deporting someone. So since that's the heart of DACA, the administrative argument that DACA is illegal was flawed. Second,
Jennifer, just to kind of break it down in a more simple way, in other words, you do the math problem and show me your work.
Yeah, show me your work. You need to go through the steps and you need to convince me that the reason that you've given is actually a legally valid reason. They failed to do that. The second thing that the court noticed was that the administration had really failed to take into account the ways in which people had come to rely on the Deferred Action Program. They said that it's important for the administration to weigh the reliance interests that are at stake, the way that people have come to shape their lives around the existence of this program. And here they said that the administration just failed to adequately take those reliance interests into account. So that was another flaw.
Now, the ruling comes as a bit of a surprise because during the oral arguments, which took place a few months ago, it seemed as if most justices were leaning toward ending the DACA program. What changed, Jennifer?
So I think even at the time of argument, it was pretty clear that there was probably a majority of judges who thought that the administration had the power to rescind DACA if the administration offered an adequate policy reason for doing so. But the live question was whether the administration had done that, whether it had given an adequate policy justification and had done the work appropriately. And in that sense, it's kind of a repeat of the same kinds of questions we saw in last year's citizenship question case, where it's clear that from the court's decision in that case that the administration can add a citizenship question, but there are concerns about whether the administration has justified doing it in the way that they've done it in this particular instance. And you might remember in that case, John Roberts sided with the liberal justices again, and said the administration hadn't done its work properly and needed to do its work properly before the court would accept the administration's change in the existing policies. And we see the exact same lineup here, Roberts joining the Liberals to say that the Trump administration needs to do its work properly if it wants to engage in these sorts of changes in policy.
We're talking to UCLA law professor Jennifer Chacon. Now, as part of the decision, 8 out of the 9 justices believe that the White House's move to end DACA was not motivated by racial discrimination. Jennifer, what's your take on that?
So that's disappointing, but I think entirely predictable. The court concluded that the plaintiffs in this case didn't adequately show that the decision was motivated by discriminatory animus, even though we know there's ample public record that the administration has expressed animus against Mexicans and Latinos many times, and that animus runs through certain portions of the administration. But this is something that we've seen before from the court. In the Trump versus Hawaii case about the Muslim ban, they also failed to find sufficient animus to find an equal protection violation. So perhaps it's not surprising that Sotomayor is alone in explaining that there is sufficient evidence of discriminatory effect and discriminatory purpose to warrant further fact-finding on the equal protection question.
So I'm wondering, Jennifer, in the short term, if someone out there is a DACA recipient, what does this mean for them legally? What should their next steps be?
So it's great news, at least for now, right? It means keep renewing your DACA, keep an eye out if you don't have DACA but meet the criteria to see if you can start applying for DACA. The court's ruling really breathes life into a program that has been teetering on the edge, and so that's the practical import of today's decision.
Now, today's ruling did leave the door open, though, for President Trump to try and end the program again. But the election's coming up really, really fast. Given how close we are to that, Jennifer, how likely is it, do you think, the president would mount another challenge? And if he did, what would his legal options be?
So I can't predict what this administration will do. I've tried in the past, and that's dangerous to try. They could go back to the drawing board and try to come up with better reasons that the court would accept for rescinding the program. This decision doesn't stop them from trying that. They may do that. As you note, the clock is ticking. I think it was noted in the earlier introductory segment that this is a popular program. So it's possible that they will leave it. And there are also still some litigation challenges to DACA in some courtrooms. So there are still possibilities that the program comes under threat. But for now, it is still a vibrant and viable.
Now, how likely is it you think that we'll see another Supreme Court case on this issue maybe next year?
It's possible if the administration again tries to rescind it and offers new and more robust justifications that we'd see it again. If they don't take that action, much might depend on who's in office in January. If an administration wants to keep DACA, they will have to defend it from legal challenges, but this decision might make that easier. What I truly hope, though, is that if there is a change in administration, there'll be a better solution than DACA for the many people who have waited a long time for a permanent legislative solution. So it'd be great if Congress stepped in here, because the courts can bat this around for a while, but what neither the administration nor the courts can do is give citizenship to the large number of people who have lived here for a really long time and are integrated in our communities. And so that's something that Congress needs to do, and hopefully will.
Yeah, and just to be clear, it is on Congress to decide this one way or another, right? If Congress keeps kicking the can down the road, DACA and DACA recipients will stay in a kind of a legal purgatory in a way.
That's right. The only body that can grant citizenship is Congress. And so it's really important for them to take that obligation seriously.
And that would be really the only way for this program to continue, no matter who's in the White House?
That's right. So, and this, we could see that limitation even with Obama. That's why the program is designed as it is. Obama had the power to not deport people using prosecutorial discretion, but the president doesn't have the power to bestow citizenship on people unless Congress does that through statute.
From a legal perspective, Jennifer, why do you think this has stayed in the air so long? I mean, it just feels like it's been such a long time and no resolution is really ever happening. It's either coming right up to the brink of getting cut, or it gets saved, and then we got to think about it another few years down the road.
Well, I think anything that you litigate takes a long time, so that's unsurprising. If you're working your way through the courts, it will take time. I think what is really amazing is the resilience of this program. And I think the reason that it has been as resilient and strong as it is because of the amazing advocacy of the community that rose up to demand it. So including many of the people who have DACA, who are really active frontline activists, who kept this issue before the public eye, who made people understand why this was important, who brought around public opinion on this issue. I think that's the fact that this is so popular, the fact that it's seen as important is the work of activists, and their work has really helped to keep the program alive. I think John Roberts would have been really uncomfortable being the force that terminated this very popular program in the face of a pretty poor explanation for rescission from the Trump administration. And that is in part, greatly in part, due to the hard work that activists have done in the streets, in the halls of Congress, on the airwaves, et cetera.
That's Jennifer Chacon, professor of law at UCLA. Jennifer, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, let's hear now from a DACA recipient. Joining us is Yasmin Franco. She was brought here from Mexico when she was 10 years old. She's a political scientist from Southern California. She's worked in the California legislature, and now she's looking to pursue a Master's of Arts in International Relations. Yasmin has been a recipient of DACA since December of 2012. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure, sure. Now, you woke up early this morning to hear the Supreme Court's ruling. First off, when you went to sleep last night, what was in your head? What were you thinking you might wake up to?
I was thinking I was going to be flooded with notifications, and I was super anxious and super full of different kinds of emotions, and I really didn't know what to expect with this court.
Did you get any sleep, actually?
I actually had a very hard time going to sleep. Yeah, it was a hard night.
So, okay, you wake up and you hear the news that the Supreme Court voted to protect DACA. What was that feeling like?
Honestly, it felt like a mixture of emotions because I know that this is only temporary. So on the one hand, I felt happy, mostly because of the people that qualified for DACA and that they could not, for one reason or another, submit their initial DACA application. So I felt relieved for them. But also I know that the president, you know, could today or tomorrow just say, okay, that was fun, and now we're actually going to do it the right way, and we're going to end the program through the correct process and protocol. And then once more, you know, we'll kind of be in this limbo in it, you know, is my permit going to be nullified, or is my permit no longer, you know, valid after 2 years, or am I going to be able to renew? Just like so many questions, really.
Yeah, that feeling of limbo, that's something you've been going through for 8 straight years, right?
Yeah, for a long time. Yeah, this whole immigration process is just excruciatingly painful.
Yeah, how does it feel to just to know that your future, possible future, is always seemingly, you know, kind of fraught in the balance, never knowing exactly how it's going to go? Because, I mean, it was good news for you today, Yasmin, but at the same time, as you said, you also still don't know what next year might bring.
Exactly. Yeah, so it honestly is just a roller coaster. I mean, sometimes you have to just not go on social media, not read any of the news, not follow it, because it can consume you. Because, you know, for someone that's just reporting the news, it's just like a piece of news. But yeah, if you're living it, you know, you're not a number, you're an actual person. And it's just really hard to live that way, not actually knowing, you know, can I invest in something? You know, can I buy a home? Should I even, you know, bother to try to get into, you know, this school? Because what if I don't have a legal permit anymore? And it's just like little things that are part of growing up. They're not as simple as they should be, and not as straightforward, and therefore not as enjoyable. Like, our experiences here are definitely shaped very strongly because of our limbo in legal status.
I'm talking to DACA recipient Yasmin Franco. What has DACA meant in your life? What has it allowed you to do? I mean, you mentioned like what you kind of can't enjoy because you don't know exactly mm-hmm. what the future will hold, but what has it allowed you to do?
Yeah, well, DACA has allowed me to basically get great internships in public service, get fellowship at the California State Legislature, have my awesome job there as well, which I thoroughly enjoyed. It does bring, you know, certain peace of mind because you know that you can work and you can provide for yourself and you can provide for your family. And, you know, at the end of the day, even though it is peace of mind in 2-year increments, it's nevertheless a little relief that other communities, like undocumented communities, can't really enjoy.
Have you ever, and I hate to even ask you this question, Yasmeen, but I'm just wondering, have you ever thought, okay, what would happen? What would I do if it's gone, if DACA is gone?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely thought about it, and it's something that I think a lot of DACA recipients go through, just kind of really sitting down with yourself and thinking about what are my options here.
You almost have to, right? You have to make that column, right? Good case scenario or bad case scenario?
Yeah, exactly. And it's difficult, but I mean, definitely all of the options, you know, you can lay them down on the table and just kind of have an honest conversation with yourself and kind of just have different plans, because you really never know what Congress is going to do. If history shows anything, it's like they can't get it together. I mean, these are, you know, elected officials, and it's just we just seem like we're a token.
How disappointing is that this is your life, and Congress can't seem to kind of move on this. How does that feel to know that your life seemingly doesn't mean as much to them as it does to a lot of other people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a painful realization, you know, to go through, but at the end of the day, you just have to accept it. I mean, just accept that, like, okay, they by themselves don't have the motivation. They don't care about you enough to actually get something done, to leave partisanship, you know, aside. And that's why, you know, you have to build allies and you have to build support. And, you know, it's about grassroots efforts and about electing people that actually represent Californians and represent Americans, not just, you know, a specific type of elected official that really is alienated from communities of color and, you know, communities that are underserved.
Yasmeen Franco is recipient of the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Yasmeen, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, just a few hours ago, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that everyone, every Californian, has to wear a mask when they're outside or in situations that are deemed high risk. We know that Orange County has pushed back on similar state mandates in the past. We'll hear how they're thinking about responding when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
We don't believe you, because we the people
are still here in the rear. Yo, we don't need you. You in the killing off good young brother
fool.
When we get hungry, we eat the same damn food.
The ramen noodles.
The simple voodoo. It's so maniacal, reliable, the pull of juju. The irony is that this bad chick in my lap. She don't love me, she don't love me, she don't study that. She don't give it to me, ain't gonna tell me what it's at. She gon' take the brain to where the plane she fit on that. My doors have signs with, don't try to rhyme with. VH1 has a show that you can waste your time with. Guilty pleasures take the edge off reality. And for a salary, I would consider it sporadically.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. I want to take a minute to give you the latest on the coronavirus situation here in California, because just a few hours ago, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that starting today, all Californians must wear a face mask while out in public and in other situations deemed high risk. It takes away a patchwork of rules that varied from county to county, city to city, and makes it clear that if you are anywhere in the state, you must use something to cover your mouth and your nose. But of course, this new order may face resistance in areas where people are rebelling against wearing those masks. And yeah, we mean Orange County. For the very latest, we have KPCC's health reporter, Jackie Fortier. Jackie, welcome back.
Hi.
Now, for this new rule, who does it apply to and under what circumstances?
Yeah, so I'm going to tweak what you said earlier. It's almost everybody.
Almost, okay.
Today, the California Department of Public Health released these updated guidelines that requires Californians to wear cloth face coverings in most indoor settings, as well as outdoor settings where physical distancing isn't possible. Workers who engage with the public will be required to wear a mask. People riding public transit, people in ride shares, people doing the ride sharing, people driving, anyone visiting a health-related office, Healy. There are also some exceptions to the rule. Young children, people with a medical condition or a disability who can't, or people that because of their jobs would be in like physical danger by wearing one.
Okay. Now, why is this order coming out now?
Well, I mean, the big reason is that COVID-19 is continuing to spread. I just checked the numbers. Overall, new cases in California are up 26% from the beginning of June. So every day, the number of people with COVID-19 is going up by the thousands, especially in L.A. County. You know, to put this in perspective, California has nearly 40 million people. So now California is the largest state to require face coverings. We're also the first state on the West Coast. 10 other states, mainly in the Northeast, which has obviously been hit really hard by the coronavirus, already require face masks. Massachusetts, for example, they've required one for over a month. And enforcement there has been kind of haphazard. It's been left largely up to local officials. From what I've heard, police there are not really issuing citations. It's basically the honor system. California's order is similar. There's no mention of enforcement in the order. I just got off the phone with officials in Riverside County. They said that they're supportive of the mask requirement, but they haven't gotten any guidance from the state on the enforcement arm.
Now, Jackie, this announcement comes after at least 7 California health officials have resigned their jobs since the pandemic began. Why have those officials stepped down?
Yeah, most of them have cited harassment and threats, including people even protesting at their houses for issuing face mask requirements. And these are requirements that are in line with the current science.
Now, despite politics, there have been some recent studies showing that masks can be very effective. What do those studies generally say about preventing the spread of the coronavirus?
Yeah, so back up real quick. The coronavirus is spread when droplets are sprayed into the air, usually when infected people talk, cough, or sneeze. And studies have shown that homemade face cloth coverings can help reduce the spread from people who are contagious but have no symptoms, which is one way it spreads, or are yet to develop symptoms. Physical distancing is also very important. So that's keeping away from other people's kind of potential speaking plume, if you will.
Oof, what a way to put that. Now, what teeth are there to Gavin Newsom's order? Who's supposed to enforce the rule, and what's the penalty?
Yeah, we really just don't know at this point. The order doesn't mention enforcement, so it's an open question. Places like L.A. County already had mask requirements, and as you may have seen, lots of people don't really follow them, partially because there's no enforcement. I think what this order really does is solidify what the rules are. So for so long during this pandemic, the buck has really been passed from the federal to the state and then down to the local level. Having a patchwork of mask rules was just super confusing for people because we don't just stay in one county, right? We move around and you don't know what the rules are. So this really also takes the onus off of businesses. Now they can point to the statewide order rather than just their own, you know, policies or even county policies.
Now, weeks ago, several places around the state resisted the governor's stay-at-home orders. Cities such as Huntington Beach even went to court about the beaches being closed. Wondering, Jackie, if we might be, on the verge of seeing another standoff between Newsom and localities, but this time over face coverings, over masks.
Yeah, you know, it's certainly possible. Orange County just had their own press conference, and I think they were kind of taken by surprise because they kind of just did their update on the numbers and they didn't have an opinion on the face requirement right now. We have seen, though, in states, like I mentioned before, that have been really hard hit that already have these orders, that there hasn't really been much pushback, but again, they're largely not enforced. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
All right, Jackie Fortier, KPCC's health reporter. Jackie, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, you know, growing up, we absorb a lot from the people who raise us. How to act, how to think, how to act in public. Many of us carry the traits of that parental figure deep into adulthood, sometimes without even realizing it. Now, that's true, especially true, in many Black households where lessons taught to children are often aimed at shielding them from the effects of racism, such as the case for Take-Two producer Austin Cross. He writes about his upbringing on our website, LAist, in a piece titled The Hidden Cost of Inherited Blackness, and he shares his story now.
My father was born 12 days before Emmett Till. July 1941 was an inauspicious time to be young and black in America. When the two round-faced baby boys came screaming into the world, they knew no color, and yet the nation's perception of theirs was already destined to shadow them, from cradle to grave. A month after his 14th birthday, young Emmett was beaten and killed for being the wrong color in the wrong place. 2 hours north, my dad, young Thomas, heard the news. He was unfazed.
People of color didn't have any rights back then. You were a boy, you were the N-word, or you were nothing,
he'd say. It could have been either of them. He knew it, all his friends knew it, but they carried on.
So you just took it in strides. That's the way it is, and it can't get any better.
That was the philosophy that kept black people safe, he told me. Except that it's not your world. Work with the system. Play the game. Do the best you can to ensure that your kids will have to deal with a little less of the bull. My father taught me the rules of being black in America. Many of his younger years were spent in the Jim Crow South. He came to Los Angeles just in time to be greeted by the Watts riots.
The burning and looting, the shooting and beating went on for nearly a week. It began, as many race riots have begun, with the arrest of a Negro by white officers, right here at this corner.
When he lost count of how many times he'd been pulled over while driving down Wilshire Boulevard, he started dressing in a suit and tie. He figured the LAPD wouldn't bother him if they thought he was a chauffeur. The pullovers stopped. He wore a tie until the week he died. Since the death of George Floyd at the hands of those Minneapolis police officers, I've thought a lot more about what my dad taught me. The omnipresence of race in our news cycle, paired with the unstructured hours of quarantine, has led me to realize the extent to which his advice has seeped into every aspect of my thought process. His guidance extended far beyond the oft-repeated hands-on-the-steering-wheel rule. In fact, it factored into the way I dress. Always be presentable. Hair combed, shirt tucked in. Into the way I speak. People won't listen if you don't sound educated. Into my demeanor. Calm, pleasant, and direct. Even into how I think about those who look like me. I hope they don't make me look bad. My father no longer lives, but I'm chagrined to report that his time-tested philosophies remain alive and well in me. It's like the inheritance I never wanted, but also kind of need every day. It was delivered in pieces over the course of 30 years with no receipt. What can I say? Thanks. I hate it. The most twisted part about this philosophy I've found is that if a person gets hurt, they're somehow at fault for not playing the game properly. For example, some insinuated Ahmaud Arbery was killed because he stopped by an unfinished house. The lesson that me and many like me are hardwired to take from this, he probably shouldn't have hung around. Then came George Floyd, who died after an officer applied pressure to his neck for nearly 9 minutes for allegedly spinning a fake $20 bill. The lesson there? I'll take dress nicely so people don't assume you're up to no good for $500. God. After more than 30 years of playing by the rules my father taught me, I understand just what I have inherited. An antique set of rusty shackles. Safety is just the byproduct of following these unwritten commands. The rules ingrained in me are merely an inversion of the regulations imposed on my ancestors by a system designed to keep us obsequious to white supremacy from the moment we stepped off the boat. Slavers encouraged these rules so that we would regulate ourselves. It's the same system, I realize, that gave us respectability politics, one of the few pathways available to black people hoping to take their seats at the far end of the economic table. My father knew that system well. He learned how to play the game. You might even say he won. But frankly, I'm tired of taking part in a system that only rewards those willing to shed their identity. If everything I have to do in order to survive is for the comfort of others, what have I left for myself? What is real? Since my dad passed, I've spent a lot of time reflecting on why I am the way I am. Last week, I asked my mom about my dad's views on race. I mentioned his apparent indifference to the death of Emmett Till. She told me a different story. When Till's body was discovered, beaten and mangled on that August day in 1955, my dad was scared. His mother was scared. His whole damn community was terrified. He just said he wasn't so that I wouldn't be. And there it was, clear as day. Like a primordial atom from which our collective psyche flows, to be black in America is to live in constant fear. We must break these chains before another generation of black children inherits the scars of their forefathers. Before another young man puts on a necktie, hoping it will function as a bulletproof vest. It's on me, and it's on you. The great activist James Baldwin once said that not everything that is faced can be changed, but he added that nothing can be changed until it is faced. Today, we're facing down a system that binds the hands of every black American. What will you do?
Fly away, oh glory, I fly away.
That was Take Two producer Austin Cross. You can read his essay, The Hidden Cost of Inherited Blackness, on our website. That's laist.com, laist.com. Now, regrettably, at one time or another, we have all seen police brutality, either in person or on video. A whole other side of police brutality exists because it happens behind prison walls. We'll hear the story of one man whose death was caught on camera, coming up on Take Two.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Look how I'm living now. Police be tripping now. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry him.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. It's partially thanks to cell phone footage that recent abuses of power, like the killing of George Floyd, have been witnessed by thousands. In the American jail and prison system, that kind of police violence mostly goes unseen. But ProPublica reporter Thalia Beatty was able to uncover footage of one case. It's a story of Philip Garcia, a 51-year-old man who died in the custody of the Riverside County Sheriff's Department after 44 hours of abuse. Thalia joins us now to talk about her reporting. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
Now, this case actually happened in 2017, but the details only recently became available. Tell us, where does it start? How did Philip Garcia end up in Riverside County Jail to begin with?
Yeah, the story of Philip Garcia is really a long story. Like you said, he spent almost 2 days in custody. It starts at his home. A neighbor called the police early in the morning reporting that Mr. Garcia had, you know, thrown something through their window and was acting very aggressive. When police arrived on the scene, they found, you know, Mr. Garcia sort of in disarray. Mr. Garcia lived with his longtime business partner, much older man, who they found, you know, pretty badly beat up, unfortunately, inside their home. And so Mr. Garcia was suspected of assault, which is a serious charge. But also at the scene, other family members told the police that this was entirely out of character, that Mr. Garcia had some medical issues, like a seizure disorder, and that they were very concerned for his health.
So he gets booked and got taken to a cell. What happened there?
Yeah, I mean, the booking itself is actually quite important. Any information that Mr. Garcia's family may have given to the police department doesn't seem to have made it into the jail with him. So intake is one of those moments where the sheriff's deputies can learn about what that person's issues are. And in this case, intake was cut short. It barely lasts 5 minutes. That really is a missed opportunity, unfortunately, in this case. Deputies divert him to a cell. He spends 18 hours overnight in isolation, where his behavior, we know from surveillance footage, is very bizarre. And he seems increasingly agitated until very early the next morning at 6 a.m., seems to have injured himself and is also literally trying to pull the light down from the ceiling. This prompts deputies to bring a tactical team in to extract him from the cell. This, you know, technically is sort of the procedure of the jail, but the force used, you know, is quite intense. They fire a stinger grenade, which is a device that fires rubber bullets and emits a large bang and smoke into the cell, and tackle him to the ground, tase him, and then drag him out into a restraint chair where, again, officers continue to actually punch him as they're restraining him to this chair. He spends, you know, a couple more hours in a different cell in isolation before one of the mental health professionals in the jail decides that he is in a psychiatric crisis and transfers him to the county hospital.
What happened then?
This is where, you know, this story, I think, really becomes quite grim. He waits for 12 hours in an emergency room, restrained partially in this emergency restraint chair and partially on a gurney. We don't know all of the details of the medical care that he received, but 10 hours later, you know, late at night, he finally gets a bed in the hospital. And the footage we have from that shows him continuing to be extremely agitated. We don't see evidence of him getting medical treatment or psychiatric treatment. And a second tactical team of deputies is called in from the jail to move him from a gurney to a hospital bed and again restrain, you know, all four of his limbs. They use a plastic shield, a large like riot shield, and press it down on his face and torso as they're doing this. And the footage we got, you know, it's just very disturbing. He cries out for help in this visceral way that you can't help but understand that he's in serious distress.
What ended up happening to Philip Garcia?
Eventually, in the hospital, he stops breathing. And deputies who were in the room with him at the time call in a nurse. And then a team of people from the emergency room arrive to provide him CPR. And of course, unfortunately, he is not resuscitated. And so he dies in the hospital after, like I said, almost 2 days in custody. The sheriff's department, which released an autopsy in this case, says that Mr. Garcia died of several things. One is death in schizophrenia, which is a diagnosis reserved really only for the unusual case where someone with a long history of mental illness dies basically and there's no other explanation for their death. The second cause of death is rhabdomyolysis, and there's more evidence that that is the cause of death in this case. It is a condition that is caused by overexertion. In this case, Mr. Garcia is straining against the restraints that he was held in, and it leads to kidney failure. And so that is the finding of, you know, of the autopsy report in this case.
We're talking to Thalia Beatty, a ProPublica reporter. The county coroner identified Philip Garcia's death as a homicide. Does that mean that the sheriff's department has taken any responsibility for this or maybe changed any of their practices?
Not that we know of. And it is important to note that in this case, the coroner system in Riverside County means that the sheriff himself is the coroner. A homicide also is not a criminal designation. It is, it means that a person died at the hands of others. So while they found that, they did not turn over any records that showed that they had disciplined any of their deputies or other staff in regards to this case. We don't know that they changed any of their policies in regards to this case. You know, the only indication of maybe their position on this is that they did settle a wrongful death lawsuit with Mr. Garcia's family and paid the family $1 million. In exchange, or as part of that settlement, the county included a non-disclosure agreement that prohibits Mr. Garcia's family from speaking to the press.
Wondering how that affected you telling this story. Did it make you maybe hesitant to do that?
Definitely. I mean, this is something we talked about at length and really until the last moment guided sort of the decisions we made about what we were going to publish and how we were going to publish it. We, you know, of course, sought to find people who knew Mr. Garcia in life and alert his family members to our reporting, offer to have let them see the video footage that we were going to release because that is such a visceral thing. We did not want them to be surprised. But we really were not able to ever speak with them. And I, of course, hold their experience in my mind like all the time. I can't guess, you know, what they experience. But the treatment of their loved one, you know, is so serious and unfortunately seems to be part of larger systemic issues in Riverside that we felt it was important to publish this story. And in many ways, we were only able to get these public records because Mr. Garcia's family had themselves filed a wrongful death lawsuit that brought a lot of these records to light initially.
This all happened 3 years ago. So why release the story now?
I started looking at this a year ago, and we spent 5 months, 9 months negotiating with the Riverside County Sheriff's Department to get these records. And so it is really only as of now that this story was done. It happens to coincide in this moment where these issues are top of mind, the treatment of people by law enforcement and transparency about that treatment. That is a coincidence of timing.
Have Riverside County officials responded to your reporting?
They did not grant us an interview. The Sheriff's Department did schedule an interview with us and canceled it the day before. Similarly, the public hospital canceled an interview that was scheduled. They did not respond to our findings letters. And if they said anything, it was that the hospital said that, you know, providing quality care is of utmost importance. And the sheriff said that there is a settlement on this and they're not going to comment further.
That's Saliha Beatty, investigative reporter with ProPublica. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, black man driving with his son in the passenger seat. All of a sudden, a black and white rolls up behind the car with their lights on. He pulls over, and after a few minutes, the interaction results in the officer pointing a gun at the car's window. Now, that is not a new scenario, but the one you'll hear about next happens in a virtual reality game created as a teaching tool where the user learns what it feels to be black in America. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm A. Martinez. The national debate centered on race and policing feels different than times past. It's a sentiment that's been echoed to us again and again by members of our community in recent weeks. Now, leading many of the discussions around what it truly feels to be black in America are young black voices using the medium of their choice to speak their truth. Now, it's with that in mind that I want to introduce you to Bryant Young, a former USC game design student who channeled his experiences navigating race in America into a virtual reality experience where the user is thrust into a digital world of a black American. It's called Our America, and Bryant Young is with us now. Welcome to Take Two.
Thanks. I appreciate you guys having me here.
Sure, sure. Okay, so when someone puts on a VR headset to experience Our America, what sort of world are they going to find themselves in? Walk us through what they'll be seeing and hearing.
So the first thing that happens is you'll hear the music start to play. It's just some background music trying to get you settled, used to the whole entire environment. And then you look down, you see your hands, you see a nice car, you see your son to your right, and then you see the neighborhood. The neighborhood's kind of like the suburbs. It's a sunny day. It looks like it's going to be very peaceful, very welcoming, very just kind of American dream type deal.
Mm-hmm. And what's happening with the people in the car?
So your son, Malcolm, is coming into the car, and he's missed the bus for like the third time this week, and you got to take him to school. Immediately, we hit the audience with something that is impactful and something that's heavy. So immediately, you come right off, and you hear that Malcolm's being called racial slurs at school on the bus, and that's why he's missing it, right? So that's where it all starts. And then from there, we build on to, it's not just about Malcolm being teasing the bus and missing the school bus anymore. Now you're trying to console him. And so just small interactions like that, slowly building it into it's this nice father-son bond where you can kind of appreciate how you're responding to Malcolm and how Malcolm's growing in the story.
Okay, now let's play a clip. You're in the car with your son, Malcolm, and then you get this call from your boss.
This isn't the day to pull one of your... You know what? Three of our very most important clients are waiting in that conference room. I can't keep stalling to make up for you and your constant tardiness. Maybe you people are on a different time, but at this company, 9:30 means at 9:25, you're late.
I phoned Rachel this morning. I had to take my kid to school. This is also the first time I heard that they were coming. If I had had a heads up...
I don't need to shuck and jive, and I don't need to give you a heads up, buddy. Work starts at 9:30, period.
All right, so there's a level of drama attached to a lot of the things that the boss says. And now you got to make some decisions. So, Brian, what can you choose to do, and how will that impact the story?
The main thing is that there's always four choices. There's two choices that will always be in there. One thing that some Black people will do, other things that Black people may think to do. And the other two choices are just kind of traps to get you to say something that you would not be able to say if you were Black in America.
And then there's pressure, too, because right there, the boss is putting some actual work pressure on the father.
Right. Exactly. The main thing that we were trying to do with this whole story is that now you get the sense of urgency, like, oh, I got to go. And just to like, because you're already late for work, you're trying to get your kid to school, and then now your boss is calling you. So now this urgency is picking up, and then it all culminates at the police stop where it's kind of like, what do I do now?
So let's get to that part. You get stopped by the police officer. Here's what that sounds like.
It's okay, Malcolm. We're just going to talk to the police. Maybe I missed a turn back there, a signal or something.
And that scene is actually based on something that happened to you and your dad in real life. Tell us that story.
So I was about 16. I was a junior in high school. We were driving back from getting my first car, just kind of like the story. It's supposed to be a very happy day for me. And we're on the interstate and we get pulled over by a cop. I immediately look over at the speedometer and I'm like, oh, we're going 70 into 70. So probably not get a ticket for speeding. I'm like, maybe lights are out or something. We pulled over. First thing my dad does is like, he looks over at me. He's like, make sure your hands are where he can see them. And so at this point I realized, because usually my dad is a very calm person, but I realize that now he's kind of like aware of like how bad the situation could go. The cop walks up. He asks us for the license registration. I remember my dad saying, he turns to the cop and says, the license registration is in the glove box. Brian, can you get the license registration out the glove box? I go to reach for the glove box, and out the corner of my eye, I see the cop spin around, reach for his weapon, and I like immediately just froze. And in that moment, I thought I was going to die. That's kind of where this whole project came from, is that I wanted people to get the chance to experience that same moment that I felt when I was driving back from my dad.
When you were creating that part of the game, and you mentioned how it's based on something that happened to you, did it bring back those memories of that? I mean, how did you work through the memories to actually put it in the game?
I was never really focused on me, myself, and my memories. It was always just, I want to create this project to create empathy for the Black community so people can know what we go through. And then also make sure that when someone else who's not Black or a person of color gets into the headset, they can also experience it and have the same emotions that we have.
We're talking to Bryant Young. He's creative director of a new virtual reality video game called Our America. Who is the audience for this VR experience? Who do you imagine would benefit the most?
I think that it has something for everyone. So a lot of times in the game industry, it's hard to find a protagonist that is a minority, right? So that's definitely something for people of color, is that they have someone to identify with in this project. But then also, on the other hand, people that aren't necessarily going to go through something like this and don't necessarily identify with a Black father, the whole idea is that when you put on the headset and you're not a person of color, that you look down, you see that you're a Black man. Because you don't actually see your body, the only thing you see are your hands. I think that that allows people to really get into the mindset. And not only that, but the fact that now you're looking over to your son on the right, and the whole buildup before the cop scene is to get you attached to your son. And once people get into that immersive state, it's very hard to detach from it.
All right, so I got to come clean here. When I first heard about what you're working on, Our America, I had to know if surviving the encounter with the police as a Black man means that you've won the game, so to speak. I mean, or actually, maybe the bigger question is this a game? Can you even win at this game?
So that's the one thing that sets this project apart from a lot of things that you would normally think of as games, is that there is no real win state per se. Like, the best case scenario is you get arrested, but as you see in the video that we posted on our YouTube page, the result of that interaction was that Malcolm actually got shot and died. So there's really no winning the game. You can survive, but there's nothing to really say allow you to beat the cop or win.
You've been working on building Our America for several years now. I mean, way before the recent Black Lives Matter protests. How do you see it fitting into this social change movement that's going on right before our eyes right now?
I think it's my way of protesting. I haven't been out in the streets since the lockdown, but this would be my way of protesting by bringing a light to our community and showing people what we experience on a daily basis.
Now, you just graduated from USC with a master's in computer science. What's next for you, Brian?
So right now I'm actually working, trying to finish Paulus's project, because right now it's in a beta state, and I want to publish that by the end of summer. And anytime you have an experience that is unique to you and you want to show other people what it's like to go through that experience, I feel like this would be a vehicle and a way to show people that.
That's Bryant Young, creative director of a new virtual reality video game called Our America. Bryant, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Our America will be available for download on Oculus and Steam in August. A beta version is available on ouramericavr.com. All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. If you missed any part of the show, just head to wherever you get your podcasts, and there we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there at A Martinez LA. That's Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back tomorrow at 2.